The wind was a very mysterious thing, but it seemed as though it was something like the motion of God through things. God walked by and the trees moved. You couldn't see what moved them, but they moved. And man felt the cold breath of wind upon his face, or the hot and heated winds of the desert, which was the breath of Typhon, the destroyer. But always, air was the breath of God, or the motion of God through things. Man began to sense that some things moved of themselves. Others were moved by an outside and mysterious power. And gradually he became aware of another motion, a motion he called destiny. How all things are moved by a mysterious, invisible moral force to an end some way predestined and foreordained. And the ancient, looking everywhere for a perfect symbol of motion, became aware also of cyclic motions, the motions of the sun and of the moon and of the stars, the motion of seasons. And he realized that motion was more than merely reaching out your hand. Motion was a great movement in space. Though he didn't know much about space, and he knew less about movement. As late as the time of the Incas of Peru, they worshipped their god when the wind went by kissing the air. They believed that there was something there that was moving all these things. And they were not, of course, privileged to enjoy our knowledge of high and low pressure areas. And as a result of that, they were not able to make nearly as many mistakes in calculating the weather as we do now. But in any event, in their primitive minds, life was motion. And they bestowed motion upon many things we would not incline to think about. For instance, today, if we lose a pair of cufflinks, we know we've mislaid it. Ancient man, if he lost something, decided it moved away. This was perfectly reasonable to his thinking. So he allowed many inanimate objects to have power of motion. And in dreams, he was able to even conceive of trees walking. He was able to have many of these thoughts, which are also carried, some of them, in the story of the Inferno by Dante. But he wanted a symbol that would some way represent the beauty, the wonder, the mystery of rhythm, of motion, and of movement. And he looked around him for something that seemed to embody this quality or these qualities more than anything else. And what he found was the serpent. And out of this came the worship of the serpent, the symbol of pure motion. Here was something that moved without feet, yet it had a body and a form. And its motion was always a strange undulating rhythm. And all over the world, the serpent symbol appeared, like the seven-headed Nagas of Cambodia and the great serpent upon which Vishnu swept through the seven eternities. Here was the winged serpent of the ancient lands of the Euphrates, the serpent raised by Moses in the wilderness. And even as late as the time of Jesus, he admonished his disciples to be as wise as serpents and as harmless as doves. The serpent gradually came to be a symbol of life motion, and from this life motion and all of its implications, there gradually came the concept of wisdom. This secondary concept, however, was due to the acceptance by the priesthood of the serpent symbol of life. In ancient times, the wise ones were the priests. Their symbols, in turn, became symbols of knowledge and of wisdom. Then the Pharaoh of Egypt placed the coiled serpent upon his forehead as a symbol of his authority. When the white-robed priests of Memphis carried their serpent-wound staffs, it was only time before the symbol of motion or vitality should also become the symbol of learning, because it was traced upon the doors of ancient schools and colleges. It was the symbol of penetration, of realization, of deepness of insight, tracing itself back again, of course, to another attribute of deity. It is still the symbol of the medical profession. Why? Because the symbol is motion. Motion is life, and motion opposes death, which is inertia. Therefore, a motion symbol is a life symbol. And it is the duty of this serpent to symbolize, therefore, the victory of the animate power over the problem of death, which is the loss of animation. And it was first found wound around the staff of Asclepius, the great Greek deity of medicine. So the serpent became a symbol. Motion was life. Life was protection. Life was continuance. Life was the guarding of things. And among the ruins of our Mayan brethren to the south, the gods and heroes stand protected by the serpent glyph in the air above them. And the winged serpent came, the serpent of the mysteries, of initiations and of secret rites. And the subterranean temples of Abalba, as described in the great work, the Popol Vuh, the sacred book of the Quiché of Central America, the temples were the serpent holes that went under the earth. The serpent, therefore, gradually gained its place, not as a symbol of evil, but as a symbol of life. Evil only by the misuse of life. That the very principle of life itself tempts men to destroy, tempts men to pervert or misuse. And that which is the greater good is also the potential cause of the greatest ill. So the serpent became one of the great archetypal symbols of religion. And we can go on with these basic symbols, one after another, but one perhaps more would be sufficient to carry our thought. Man studying man also made certain discoveries, and these discoveries in turn were affected psychologically by a series of other factors. Gradually there arose in early society a tribal kind of existence. A tribe must have a chieftain. It must have someone to lead. For from a very early time, man realized that all men could not lead. And there had to emerge the strong one, the hero. And in time, this heroic descent became a fixed pattern. Probably at the beginning and even later in some areas, the chieftain was elected. But it gradually became an hereditary prerogative that the tribe was ruled by the powerful one. And if he was not powerful enough in his own estate to gain the necessary recognition, he was given various attributes. He was permitted to wear a certain special raiment of authority. He wore more ornamentation, more jewels, more crowns than other men. He had a larger house to live in, which gradually became a palace. But by degrees, even though he might still be only a human being, he was surrounded by defenses and props, by means of which he became separated more and more from the other members of his clan, until he gained the mysterious psychological aura of authority. I know in years ago, when you could still go to Peking, I saw there in the Imperial Museum the coronation armors of the Emperor of China. These armors were of solid chain gold. And the emperor, when it came time to put on his full coronation regalia, was not physically able to carry its weight. Therefore, he was seated on his throne. A device like a T-cross was placed behind him on the level of his shoulders, and his robes were draped on that and over him. He could not carry the weight of his own robes. This shows what has happened and what does occur in the effort to make the individual seem different, to seem more important than before. Today, we do not bother to put a heavy robe over the front of him, or a T-square or a cross behind him to sustain it. All we need to do is pin on his chest his bank book, and everyone worships of their own accord. But anyway, that is the way it was in old times. And in the course of time, the cults were no longer so clearly differentiated. The tree worshippers or the earth worshippers came closer to the fire worshippers. Those to whom the sun was the great symbol met and mingled their culture with those to whom the serpent was the great symbol. And in the course of thousands of years, these different streams formed a vast and elaborate chemistry of interrelationships. And as people grew wiser, the relationships were no longer merely of emblems. It wasn't merely that we swapped fetishes. The meanings behind the emblems mingled along with the physical symbols themselves. And a faith that had only one essential symbol suddenly realized that there was more than one, and either added its attributes to their own symbol or accepted the two symbols, as in the case of the raising of the brazen serpent, where according to the ancient records, Moses raised the serpent upon the T-cross of the Egyptians. Here, two symbols, originally far separate, met for the first time, perhaps, among these people. But the thoughts mingled also, and by degrees, compounds were created. First, two symbols met, releasing a new and larger religious content. These two, in the course of time, having met, perhaps broke again because the cement was not strong enough, and went on for a time isolated, each, however, with a certain borrowing from the other. Then, in turn, these separated ones mingled with others that had met and separated, until gradually this tremendous chemistry of the interrelating of basic concepts have resulted in the emergence of the seven great religions known to the ancients. Some of these have not survived, but in the original pattern, these religions became the vast institutions, each of which brought together into some suitable pattern for its own purpose the heritage of man's basic spiritual convictions. The symbols, of course, always were the emblems of these convictions. And the more of them mingled, the more complete became man's concept of deity. Because once, to one stream perhaps, deity was almost solely the concept of generation. To another, however, it was almost entirely the concept of endurance or physical survival. Others, in turn, saw in it light or warmth. So when light and warmth met, intellectualism became illumined with mysticism. The old symbols got their deeper insights. And we no longer would like to believe that we are sun worshippers. We are, whether we know it or not. We would not like to believe that we are fire worshippers, but we are. The instincts and principles have never ceased. We may not want to feel that we are depending upon rock for the survival of our memories, but we do in many ways, because the main principle is we all want to be remembered. And this releases the principles. We no longer worship the symbol of motion, but there is really no difference between that and the peculiar feeling we get at the pit of the stomach when we talk about atomic fission. It's the same principle. We are dealing with energy, power, mind, generation, law. We are dealing with these great concepts that have flowed downward into the faiths of the day. Now, anyone who studies religion, and this is not necessarily any reference directly to our faith, anyone who studies religion is exposed to comparative religion. I have known persons associated with many religions who have taken large advantage of the privileges and opportunities of their own faiths. And it is quite a mistake to assume that other religions are not aware of the comparative factors. I know I discussed this once with a very well-enlightened and well-instructed Muslim. Now, the Muslim is a very devout person to his own faith, and he is not inclined easily to stray from it. But he was perfectly frank to say that the old scholar that instructed him, and of course in the Muslim faith, the priest is a teacher rather than a preacher, The old scholar who instructed him clearly indicated how these symbols had come down from Egypt and Chaldea and from all the mysterious parts of the world of ancient times. There was no hesitance in this, and was perfectly willing to comment thoughtfully upon comparative religion. The same is true in Buddhism. An educated Buddhist perhaps will know as much about Christianity as the average Christian. We do not realize it, but it is common fact. We judge these things not by the scholar, but by the average person who may not know too much about his own faith and therefore not much about anyone else's. But the fact remains that all religions of importance in the world today do teach comparative religion. Sometimes they teach it in order to try to emphasize the superiority of their own. Sometimes, however, they are pretty honest in their effort to understand various streams of belief that have contributed to make man's faith as it is today. So we cannot say definitely that the study of comparative religion is essentially wrong. A number of very brilliant scholars in comparative religion have arisen in Christianity. Some of the most brilliant have also been Catholic priests. But they are not to be confused with the average believers in these things who are not equipped with this particular or specific type of research instinct. But the information is available. And it is not impossible for the average person to work with it if he wants to. Out of these problems, there will arise one very practical thought. One that we do need, and we need it badly. Comparative religion has unfolded very critically and very consistently in the great chart of General Furlong. Comparative religion is one of the answers to the problem of world unification today. Today, we may judge the population of the world largely by its religious factors. So let us say that for the moment the world has a population of between 2.25 and 2.5 billion human beings. Figures sort of fluctuate a little bit around 2,400,000,000. Of this group, in round terms, Christianity has a following of approximately 800 million. Of this 800 million, there are several denominations. Probably the Catholic Church leads with about 450 million. Protestantism with about 200 million following. The Eastern Church, including the Greek Orthodox and Russian Church, about 150 million. In addition to this, there are a number of smaller groups. Against or in this pattern also, we have Muslimism with a following of approximately 350 million. Buddhism with an approximate following of 500 million. Hinduism with an approximate following of 300 million. This leaves us one of the largest areas involved, China. The religious situation there is pretty difficult to clarify at the moment. But we have a population of about 600 million, divided into a number of religious groups, of which three are dominant, Buddhism, Taoism, and Confucianism. And no one knows just how much inroad modern thinking has made upon these groups, but probably, potentially, psychologically, and archetypally, the Chinese consciousness has not changed so completely as to destroy all religious valuation, and probably two-thirds of the Chinese are still addicted to some strong philosophical, moral, or cultural code above politics. Now, when we get through with adding this together and not allowing very much for primitive peoples who still worship their Lares and Penates, we still have a rather interesting discovery to make, that on the statistics available, it is rather doubtful if more than 5% of the Earth's population is either agnostic or atheistic. This is rather an interesting discovery. In fact, if we add together all the followings, we have more than the total population, but we have to be a little bit conservative. and also realize that in some faiths, following is by birth. By other faiths, following is by allegiance at maturity, so that it is a little difficult to estimate all of these factors adequately. But we do know that the majority of the religions of the world represent emphasis. Emphasis upon certain streams of concept that have descended from these primitive patterns. That by this time, all of them have been admixtured with all others, so that no actually clear line of demarcation is actually possible. If we are surprised and concerned over cultural fusion, we must also be prepared to accept religious fusion, for it has happened. We cannot differentiate today any religious group and say that it has been unconditioned or untouched by any other religious group. So that today most religions, whether they know it or not, are to a measure comparative. I remember, as I think I've told you before, discussing this with the ecumenical patriarch Athenagoras of the Eastern Church, and he very frankly told me, he said, of course, our rituals, our sacraments, our rites, everything practically we have came from Egypt. We know that. In other words, there is no doubt of the descent of these lines of religious worship. If we remove the Christian factor from Islam, we'd have very little left. If we remove the Jewish factor from Christianity, we'd have a very large hole. If we removed Hinduism from Buddhism, again, we would make a very serious scar in the structure as it now exists. And we have other faiths such as Shintoism, the doctrines of the Jains and the Sikhs. We have many other religions, each of which is to a measure dependent upon the others. So we are fighting a losing fight, consciously and intellectually, when we try to isolate religions and try to assume that there is nothing to be gained from a comparative study of their philosophies. A great deal to be gained. Let us take the average person today who has certain needs. Now, we can say without question that almost any one of the major religions of the world could supply most of the ordinary spiritual consolations required by the needs of the average person. This is true. But at the same time, there are reasons why this is not effective in operation. To some persons, the elaborate symbolisms of the past are frightening. To other individuals, that which is strange or different is in itself an adversary. We are afraid of what is not familiar to us. It isn't possible in operation for us to be quite as interdenominational as we might wish to be psychologically. But today, modern man has many problems. And his problems are hereditary. We can say, for example, Western civilization is perhaps 5,000 years old, counting most of the streams of the Greco-Egyptian culture lying behind it. Might be 7,000 years old. We won't bicker over a couple of thousand years. But we are faced with problems now that have been already assailed or integrated by other peoples. For instance, in the West, we have been a very progressive, active culture. Europe, America has been always on the move. Now we are confronted with a problem of there's not much more place to move to. This presents another situation. Up to now, we've always walked out on a bad situation by moving into new territory. Now there is no new territory, and we are confronted with the desperate difficulty of staying where we are in the middle of the situation. We can't get out of it anymore. Now, we haven't much psychological background to face this with. It has not been our way of life. Theoretically, our faiths should cover it. And in a measure, in principle, they do. But when we are in a specialized dilemma, we generally look for a specialized solution. We can say, for example, that in problems of living, grandfather's wisdom should be enough. And in all problems, we should go to grandfather who has lived longer and say, now look, how would we handle this? But our tendency today is to doubt the wisdom of this procedure. If we are in legal difficulties, we go to a lawyer, not grandfather. Because we recognize there are problems now that grandfather doesn't understand very well. He lived in another generation. If we get sick, we are not inclined to depend upon grandfather's ancient knowledge of botany. We begin to look for something else. If we decide to buy real estate, we are not going to depend on grandfather. We're going to try and find an expert. We're going to find someone who has specialized in this procedure. So in our religious needs today, we have a world to choose from, of peoples who have specialized various aspects of their own spiritual needs. As we get older and become a little more introverted and have to sit on the ancient territory a little more tightly than ever before, perhaps we will find more consolation in the wisdom of China than we will in our own particular treatment of philosophy. Where China is an old and patient culture that has gone through as much more corruption than we have ever known and is still psychologically striving with the problem of helping the Chinese as an individual to live with himself. And he's had an awful lot of experience in it. We also begin to wonder whether our artistry or our various cultures are as helpful as they should be. We look at our architecture, it kind of makes us half sick. We look at our painting, that makes us entirely sick. And we begin to say, what has happened to beauty in our Western world? And then out of another country and out of another religion, Buddhism through Zen into Japan and Korea, comes this concept of shibui. The propriety of things. Now, the principles of Zen are in Christianity, but we've never done anything with them. But another people with another problem took that angle of the problem and worked on it. They made it work for them. Now, we could do the same. We could start from scratch and build also. But it's almost too inviting to find another person or another group that is accomplished in these areas. Therefore, our tendency is to move into what they have accomplished and try to adapt it for our own need. This isn't heresy. This is common sense. And so we go among other people of the world. Some races have gone far in art, some in music, some in literature. Some religions have given us great spiritual consolation. Others have stimulated great mental thoughtfulness. And so we have a wonderful heritage of beliefs today. And out of this wonderful heritage must ultimately be revealed what seems to me to be the basic problem involved. Just as recent researches in philology have indicated that there was a mother language beneath all the tongues of earth, that we are all speaking dialects of a basic language now forgotten, I think we may also say that there is a basic religion, a blazing star of spiritual beginnings, perhaps represented in part at least by Furlong's wonderful mingling of the rivers of faith. But that there has been from the beginning a religion, an eternal, universal, unchanging spiritual principle. That the essential ideals surrounding this core religion, like the petals of a flower, or in Eastern thought, the beautiful flowering of the lotus, that these basic beliefs and ideas form together with their central core one magnificent religious concept. That this concept has slowly broken up by the processes of involutionary motion. It has been divided and scattered and tossed about throughout the world. The seeds have fallen on all kinds of ground, and due to the different kinds of soil, they have grown to be slightly different. But while not perhaps immediately recognizable, they are essentially the same. Gradually, by our evolutionary process, the demand of our spiritual culture for totality, all of these fragments must be gathered together again. The broken up streams of religion must be reunited. The great pattern of religious motion, which we have known, is one great movement based upon an utter human need, upon a complete dependence of man upon ideal, truth, and principle for survival. And in this world of confusion as we now know it, I've always felt that religious confusion is the most tragic of all, because it means that we have not achieved that degree of insight in which we can unite the best part of ourselves for the solution of common problems. While we are not able to unite our understanding of God, while we are not able to unite our archetypal concept of the purpose for existence, or the essential unity of life, or the inevitability of law, or the glory and splendor of the unfoldment of one plan to one purpose, while these visions are deficient in us, our spiritual potential is unable to exercise its directive at this time when it is so decidedly necessary. Through comparative religion, however, some of the pressures of prejudice and barriers of creed will inevitably be broken down. As soon as we are able to even study together, think together, plan together, in our search for religious value, we will attain a great deal. But whereas at now our religious unity is lagging behind the dream of political unity, actually our religious unity and our spiritual core understanding should lead all other phases of our culture. That which is most important must come first, and must also be the directive over all else. The only directives that we have that are adequate are directives based upon such principles as the Decalogue of Moses, or the Sermon on the Mount, or the famous disciplines and commandments of Buddhism, or the essential moral code of Vyasa, or the great ethical code of Confucius. These are the codes upon which the unities of peoples can be logically and reasonably established. These codes in themselves are compatible. In fact, they are practically identical. And if we go far enough into the heart of a religion, we find the common religion of mankind. But we haven't gone far enough. We have been content to do the same thing with religion that we have done with most other departments of our society: to specialize it, to departmentalize it, to accept progress in the terms of division rather than readdition. Therefore, we regard ourselves as advancing because we break up knowledge into smaller segments and examine these segments more intensively. Actually, what we need is to bring these segments together and examine the unity more intensively. If we can remove from the average person's life his religious uncertainties or his religious intolerances, if we can release his energy from the level of religious criticism, more to be used for the terms of the advancement of the common good of man, we could escape from the loss of energy resulting from continual division and antagonism. And this division and antagonism is of no practical value to us now, and hasn't been from the beginning, only we didn't realize it. As we must be a united world today to achieve the survival of our way of life, we must also realize that what we call our way of life is essentially an extension into politics of our moral conviction. And our moral conviction, in turn, is an extension into morality of our spiritual foundation. Therefore, our way of life is essentially an expression of our religion. If we can unite our spiritual conviction, we can help to unite our way of life, to bring together all the energies and resources that are now wasted in a kind of moral, intellectual, or spiritual feudalism. We are past this stage. We are up to the time of the need for the bringing together in sincere friendship all human beings of good intention, of kindly purpose, and of spiritual insight. This means that also in ourselves, each of us must take the several religious selves that make up our personality, the various conflicts of religion, morality, and ethics in our own natures. These must be reconciled. They must be brought together so that in the life of each person, the best in him guides the rest. If he can achieve this, his own religious position will be clear. And he will realize what men have always known who were thoughtful, namely that man's searching for truth from the beginning, by his own very nature, the ultimates can only be ultimately known. The search for truth today is not to be a battle of persons who believe they have found all the answers. The search for truth today is an honest realization that out of unity, cooperation, and the continuance of all good things, man is gradually growing up to the condition in which he can know the answer. So today, almost all of our bigotries and prejudices are wars of opinion, for man as yet cannot experience the full mystery of religion. But he can and has been able to demonstrate that to the degree that he brings peace in his own life, his religious principles have a better chance. And to the degree that through religion he can bring peace to society, to the nations and faiths of the world, to the degree that they become friendly and peaceful, to that degree they are in a better condition to advance their own insight and to unite in the common improvement of the world. I feel, therefore, that through comparative religion, we can remove one great source of energy waste, and that is sectarianism, and come finally to an appreciation of the spiritual integrities of those of all faiths, and gain a willingness to use truth wherever we can find it. For it is truth that will correct error. And if we reject a part of truth, we perpetuate a part of error. So from a quiet study of all of these facts and values, I think we do get a little better foundation on which to build our own attitudes for the world of the future, which will need and must have a spiritual guidance that is firmer and truer and deeper than that which is available today. Time's up.